The truth is that when you reach for simple sort of definitions like that, you're losing a lot of what value investing is about. It seems to me there are three core elements to value investing. And as economic circumstances change and as financial market circumstances change, how you implement those elements is going to change. And if value investing is going to continue to be a useful approach, it's going to have to adapt to those changes in circumstances. So the first thing about really where Ben Graham and David Dodd started is with the idea that Mr. Market is crazy, but he's not crazy about everything. So you have to have a sensible search strategy for where you're going to look for opportunity. Now, that's something that's changed an enormous amount as people have learned that looking for out of favor, cheap stocks is generally a good idea. And for most of the time, staying away from high priced glamour stocks is also a good idea. The sense in which that's changed is that as people have learned to do that, and I think you pointed this out actually in some of your comments to me, it no longer really works that well because it's crowded in those areas. So I think the big change that's happened is you have to be a specialist today. Because when you look for an area for you to search, ultimately, you're looking for an area where you're going to be the person on the right side of the trade.
Well, it's my pleasure to introduce legendary professor of value investing and a guru to Wall Street's gurus, Mr. Bruce Greenwald. Professor Greenwald is the director of Helburn Center for Graham and Dodd Investing and teaches finance and asset management at Columbia Business School. Professor Greenwald has authored two wonderful books on value investing, From Graham to Buffett and Beyond, whose second edition came out recently last year, and my favorite, Competition Demystified. Professor Greenwald, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the show, sir. Thank you for coming.
Yeah, can I correct just one thing about that? Because I'm now officially retired. So Tano Santos is the head of the center.
Okay.
Also, of course, a professor at Columbia.
Absolutely. I did not know that. Well, happy to come. And, well, Professor, I would just like to begin with your definition of value investing, because what we see here is that there many ways to go about just value investing in itself as a strategy. You have low price to book, you have investing in high ROIC, EBITDA type companies, high quality cheap companies. And then you have activism, which is really creating value through either margin expansions, better management execution. So, I mean, with all of these different styles of value investing that exists right now, what is value investing to you?
Okay, I think that's a really great place to start because the truth is that when you reach for simple sort of definitions like that, you're losing a lot of what value investing is about. It seems to me there are three core elements to value investing. And as economic circumstances change and as financial market circumstances change, how you implement those elements is going to change. And if value investing is going to continue to be a useful approach, it's going to have to adapt to those changes in circumstances. So the first thing about really where Ben Graham and David Dodd started is with the idea that Mr. Market is crazy, but he's not crazy about everything. So you have to have a sensible search strategy for where you're going to look for opportunity. Now, that's something that's changed an enormous amount as people have learned that looking for out of favor, cheap stocks is generally a good idea. And for most of the time, staying away from high priced glamour stocks is also a good idea. The sense in which that's changed is that as people have learned to do that, and I think you pointed this out actually in some of your comments to me, it no longer really works that well because it's crowded in those areas. So I think the big change that's happened is you have to be a specialist today. Because when you look for an area for you to search, ultimately you're looking for an area where you're going to be the person on the right side of the trade. And in the old days, staying away from the glamour stocks and focusing on the ugly out of favor stock did that for you. That doesn't really work anymore. Today, people seem to resist, and I don't quite understand why, because in medicine and every other field, everybody's specialized, they resist being specialists. Now, it doesn't mean just one industry, doesn't mean just one geography, but you've got to start thinking about focusing in an area where you're the expert. So I think a sensible search strategy is absolutely an essential part of value investing. And I think all value investors should be able to articulate what that is and how it evolves as old strategies become too heavily populated. The second thing, and this is in a sense why value investing is value investing, you have to know what you're buying. You can't sort of speculate on an uncertain dream in the future. You have to have a sense that this is what my return is going to be, or this is the value of what I'm purchasing. Another way to say that is, and again, because it's all about being on the right side of the trade, because every time you buy something thinking it's a good idea, somebody else is selling it to you thinking that's a good idea. You have to have a superior valuation methodology. And in a sense, that's really what the second edition of the book is all about. So it's a sensible search strategy. It's a superior valuation methodology. And then the last thing really doesn't change. It is the discipline to wait until you have a reasonable margin of safety and not to just jump in because you're bored or because you don't see anything to do, that in those circumstances, you have a good, well thought out default strategy like buying index funds, if that's what you're gonna do, but that you are disciplined about the actual investment choices you make. And those three things are the heart of value investing. And as I say, the first two, I think, have changed dramatically over the last 20 years.
Okay. Absolutely. And well, digging deeper, and you know, this was the one big idea that I found this absolutely, it was just, you know, the light bulb went on in my head. Was the idea of how you, you know, you distill what the most strongest moats are out there. Economies of scale and customer captivity, if you can find a combination of those two in a business, that's the way I want to move. And could you speak a little bit about that idea? How you
I think that basically when you invest, as I say, you have to know what you're buying. If you are buying in a competitive industry, if demand goes up, it just attracts a lot more competition. And any profit advantage from the higher demand gets competed away. If costs go down, you make temporary profits, but then everybody enters trying to take advantage of that. Prices go down. Product offerings fragment the market more thoroughly. And again, consumers benefit from that. So what you absolutely have if you're going to earn superior returns is barriers to entry. And if you don't earn superior returns, growth has no value. So there are a whole bunch of industries, natural resources, real estate, competitive businesses with no barriers to entry, but you can't worry about and pay for growth as most people try and do under those circumstances. So what you've got to do is segment the world into businesses that benefit from barriers to entry and businesses that don't. And there is, it turns out, a simple numerical number that will tell you how high the barriers are, or in the language you just articulated, how wide the moat is. And the first element to that is economies of scale expressed as the minimum sustainable market share you need to be viable. So if you look at the global automobile market, it's so big, people are viable at 2% share. And you're not going to keep anybody out in that world. If you look at cell phones, you can see around the world, people who have 10% share, 8% share, 12% share don't make money. People who have 15 to 20% share break even, you got to be above 20% share to make money. So the minimum sort of profitable share is sort of 15 to 20% there, and you want to be above that. If you look at caffeinated soft drinks, where you've got these huge local infrastructures to deliver what are very heavy products, typically you have to have at least 25% of those local markets to be viable. So that's where you start. And that's where the economies of scale cut. And just by looking around at the industry structure, you can get an idea of what that number is. Well, the second thing is, how long is it going to take your rivals to acquire that level of share? And that has to do with market share stability in a contested environment. So if I have lower costs, that's clearly going to give me share stability. It's not just about customer captivity. So it's looking at market share stability in a contested environment. In the automobile industry, that number is 2% a year of share changes hands on average. So you've got a 2% viability threshold. You can acquire share at 1% a year. That's a two-year moat. That's nothing. There are no barriers there. If you look at cell phones, you've got to sort of get, say, to 15%. Turns out about 0.5% changes hands every year in a contested environment. That's a 30-year moat. That's starting to be a much more protected market. You look at caffeinated soft drinks, again, you got to get to 25% locally because these are local monopolies in that case. Coca-Cola makes 108% of its operating profits in just 10 markets. And basically 0.2% market share changes hands every year in a contested competitive environment. Well, to get to 25% at 0.2% a year, that's 125-year moat. That's a moat. And that's not going to go away for Coca-Cola, even though you may have growth within the moat and or shrinkage within the moat. That's the measure of the moat. And I think that's the number everybody wants to think about and concentrate on when they evaluate the businesses they're getting into. Now, then there are two other dimensions to the moat. The first is the one I just described, which is the market growing or shrinking behind that moat? And obviously, it's much better if it grows than it shrinks. But the second thing is technology changing those parameters? Is this a franchise? Is this a moat that's going away or not? And that's a separate thought experiment. It has to do with how your competitive advantages are changing, how the economies of scale are changing in response to technological and other developments. But I think you've identified in that question the absolutely crucial elements when you start evaluating franchise businesses and you start paying for growth.
Just an extension of that, when we speak about growth, I think there's a lot of maybe misconception about how value and growth are sort of related, how you know, stocks are classified into either value or growth buckets, when in fact they are sort of tied at the hip because growth is part of value. My question would be, how would you go about valuing growth from a value perspective, and how much of a premium would you be able to pay for that?
Okay, so that's a terrific question. So let me just start with, they may be joined at the hip, but they're not Siamese twins. So I think, remember, we talked about having superior valuation methodologies, and there is no one-size-fits-all valuation approach. So if you are doing event investing, which is relatively short-term horizon, it's very often fixed income-based, so there are well-defined payoffs, that's a circumstance in which a DCF works well. And for that kind of investing, you want to do DCF scenarios and you want to assess the relative probabilities of different outcomes. And that's one whole approach. And that's not really either, you know, growth or traditional value investing, but there is a large element of that for all value investors. And again, if I'm a specialist in a particular industry or geography, I'm going to think about event opportunities in that industry or opportunity. The second set of circumstances are the ones we talked about. It's the no barriers to entry. And there, because growth is not going to have value and you shouldn't fool yourself into thinking it does, real estate, natural resources, competitive businesses, You want to do asset value, reproduction value of the assets, and earnings power value. And then think about whether management is destroying value because earnings power is way below asset value, or, you know, yeah, that they're about the same, which is you've got triangulated value. So that's a second set of situations. And again, if I'm an expert in an industry or geography, I'm going to see opportunities like that. There are going to be competitive situations. Growth only has value in franchise businesses. Again, because what happens if there's competition is you invest $100 million in growth. Competition is going to mean that you're going to earn the cost of capital. If the cost of capital is 8, you're not going to earn 16% forever, because people are going to enter and take advantage of it and drive the return down. So without those barriers to entry, growth has no value. So this third area, and that's why I say, once you're in the growth business, you're only looking at certain kinds of companies in certain kinds of markets. And there's a fundamental problem. It is almost impossible to put a reliable value, even in these stable franchise businesses. And the reason is clear, because the value is way out there in the future, because the far distant future has enormous value when growth has value. And to give you an idea of just what the numbers look like, and I think this is important, today, probably a cost of capital reasonably that you'd like to earn is 8%. A growth rate for franchise businesses is maybe 4%. So if you look at the value of that, it's going to be the current cash flow times 1/8 - 4, which is 1/4%, which is 25 times. But if you are just 1% off, so it's not 8%, it's a 7% cost of capital. It's not 4% growth, it's 5% growth. And remember, we're looking at the very long-term future here. That's 1/3%. That's not 25 times, that's 33 times. I mean, that's it's 1/2%, 50 times. It's 7 - 5, which is 50 times. If it goes the other way, so the cost of capital is 9 and the growth rate is 3, you're 1/6%, which is 16 times. So you got a range of valuations within your ability to forecast what this industry is going to look like from 16 to 50 times current earnings. That is not a useful valuation measure. What you have to do in those cases is you have to look at prospective returns. What you have to say is, if I buy at this price, this is the earnings return. If they're giving, say, that 6% and they're distributing 60% of it, I got a 3.6% cash return, if I think those are stable numbers. They're reinvesting 2.4%, and I care a lot about how well they do that. So if they're creating $1.50 of value because they're really good at it, that's another 3.6%. If they're creating 10 cents of value, that's almost nothing. So I still just got the cash return. And then you get the organic growth, usually without a significant amount of investment. And typically that's going to be driven for stable businesses by GDP growth. And you might be talking about GDP plus 1, which might be 4.5%. So you have a 3.6% cash return, maybe a 3% active investment return if you've got a good management that's good at deploying capital, and a 4%, say, organic growth return. So you're talking about a 10% return. And you can compare that to what you think a reasonable cost of capital is, and that'll give you a margin of safety in return space. And that will enable you also to do what we talked about, but growth investors typically don't do, which is face the possibility that this franchise is going away. So if this franchise has a 36-year life, well, the rule of 72 says it's gone with 50% probability at a rate of 2% a year. And your margin of safety has to cover that. So you have to sit down and think about what these fade rates look like and whether the margin of safety covers it. And that's a very simple framework where everything is linear in these judgments that you're going to make. And these are judgments that you can make sensibly. And you're doing them in industries that you're highly familiar with, where you're sure the franchise is stable, where it's not Tesla, where who the hell knows what it's going to look like in 10 years. And I think that's what value-based growth investing looks like. Starts with understanding the franchise, because no franchise, no growth value. and it looks at a return and looks for a margin of safety of the return over the cost of capital that will cover a reasonable estimate of a safe rate. And that's where the opportunities have been. And I think value investors who do that have done extremely well.
And in addition to that, I mean, what we've seen over the past decades with these record low interest rates that have persisted over that period of time, valuing assets is just very tricky, because how would you go about?
I don't think you can. I think that's another problem. When the interest rates are this low and this crazy, that by itself moves the value way out into the future. That's why I say you have to start looking at returns here. Now, if there's no value to growth, then you can look at what's sitting there today, the asset value, the earnings power value. But usually, and here's the thing that I think has undermined value investing. If you look from basically 1950 through 1990, the dominant force in the world is globalization. Yep. Automobile markets are going global. You know, appliance markets are going global. All manufacturing markets are going global. That means intensified competition. And as the moats disappear in those industries, so you look at General Motors. In the 70s, General Motors made a 46% return on capital. In the 80s, it made a 28% return on capital. In the 90s, it made a 7% return on capital. Then it went bankrupt. That in that world, for those kinds of companies, the Nifty 50, growth was always disappointing. So when value investors said, we don't pay for growth, for that 40-year period, they got lucky. But what's happening now is we're moving from big global manufacturing markets to local service markets. And that applies, by the way, to the manufacturing companies. So for example, you look at the leading car wash machine manufacturer, which is a German company, of course, in the world, they have 1,800 employees. Of those 1,800 employees, 200 are overhead, and the CEO wasn't even aware of this. Of the remaining 1,600, 350 make car wash machines, develop car wash machines, design car wash machines. 1,250 service and sell car wash machines. This is a local service company. And the thing about local markets is they're small markets. And the thing about small markets is you can get a dominant share. And that measure of moats that we talked about is going to be in several years. So as you've moved from manufacturing to services, and companies like here have understood this and have had very focused geographic strategies, growth has had value. And you see it, by the way, the profit share of GDP, which had been falling through from 1950 through 1990, has risen since then from about 8.5% of GDP to about 13% of GDP. So now you have to think about growth opportunities. The world is changing in the direction of growth. And you say, I don't do growth, you're going to miss out on a lot of opportunities. It's not a good strategy.
Absolutely. And not only is growth been the tricky part for value investing, for value investors, I should say, for a long period of time, but also technology. And we have moved from manufacturing to a more service-based economy over the past few decades. And I think the aversion or this sort of avoidance of technology stocks altogether by the value investing community has sort of now been beginning to be scrutinized.
Well, I mean, again, the crucial thing is, can you know what you're buying? Yeah. So there are stable technology stocks that have been around for a long time. Microsoft, Oracle, Adobe, Intel. They've been around now for 40 years plus. And all the evidence is they dominate niches. That is local markets and product space. And that doesn't seem to be going away. And you have stable histories there. And if there are stable histories, there are going to be opportunities. I mean, Google is actually reasonably stable too. And in 2011, it was trading at a ridiculous price. And if you actually sold options at the same time, you could get it at 9 times earnings. Really? And that was clearly a dominant business. Now, That means there are going to be opportunities in technology, but they're not going to be Tesla, where we really have no idea how stable the franchise is. We have no idea what the growth rate looks like. So technology is not a barrier to sensible value investing, especially when you do these return calculations, and especially when you are a specialist and an expert in that technology, and you know those companies. So there are lots, for example, of applied software companies in Turkey and places like that. And if you're an expert in them, those are stable businesses and have been stable businesses for a long time, that you can get an idea of whether you have a sensible return at the current market price and you have a margin of safety. So again, I think the critical things you always come back to with value investing are, you have a sensible search strategy. Are you looking in areas where you're going to be on the right side of the trade? And do you have a good valuation methodology where you're not trying to value things that aren't valuable, or you're not trying to calculate returns that can't be reliably calculated? And then just being disciplined about waiting for your chance.
Absolutely. And in addition, I mean, there's so many intangibles in value investing, things that you cannot put a number to. One of them is management, which is extraordinarily important, and the ability to allocate capital. How do you suggest value investors should go about evaluating management's?
Okay, that's a really good question. And I think there are qualitative things you want to look for, and then there's actually a quantitative number you want to look for. In the book, we actually do this for a company which is Intel. So the qualitative thing about management is, and remember, this is mostly going to be for franchise businesses, because the bad managements are usually going to die in the competitive markets. And therefore, ideally, they'll get taken over and the asset values to circulate. So we're now talking about the franchise businesses. The first thing you want these companies to do is the boring everyday stuff of improving operating efficiency. So when you go to talk to that management, you want to look at their record of growing margins without crazy investments, without sort of trying to do leading edge technology, just every day paying attention to small improvements and have a record of growing margins. So that's the first thing you want to look for, and you can quantify that. When you project out organic growth, it's going to be organic growth in sales, which is driven by economic conditions, but also organic growth in margins. It's going to be driven by technology and management. Second thing is, when they retain your money, remember we talked about retained earnings, you want to know what kind of value they're going to create. Now, again, start with qualitative. They better be investing where their competitive advantages carry over. That is, in the markets they're already in or the adjacent markets where their economies of scale apply. And if they're going to China and all over the world, and especially if they're doing it in an undisciplined way, forget about it. They're not going to create value. But then you can look at their expansion history, because they typically have to report geographic and other segment performance. And you can look at the returns that they've generated. You can also look at their history of acquisitions. And there is a number that we talk about in the book, which is a value creation factor. For every dollar that they retain and reinvest in active sort of expansion of their business, how much value do they create? For Intel, that number is about 20 cents. Because what they do is spend $16 billion on Mobileye that has nothing to do with their core business, where they bring nothing to the table, where they almost certainly overpay. And the other one they did was programmable chips. And since they reported that segment after they bought it, you could see that they were earning about a 20% of their cost of capital on what they spent on that business, which was another close to $12 to $16 billion. So tracking what management does qualitatively and tracking it quantitatively and getting the history of margin expansion that they generate and the value creation factor when they go into new businesses, those are both important qualitative measures, and they fit linearly into this return calculation that we talked about.
Absolutely. Well, the other question that, you know, I get from a lot of our interns and, you know, just a lot of students, from other students, is how can you get an edge when you have over 10,000 hedge and mutual funds looking at 3,700 listed public securities? You mentioned, obviously, being where you concentrated, being an industry expert. What would you suggest? About, I mean, should people look at emerging markets?
No, they should just be specialists. So I am actually chairman of a hedge fund in Europe. We've been in business. We went into business in the summer of 2007. We've outperformed our indices by, depending on the year, 8 to 9%. And we've done special deals, which you can do. So we've done a number of these. If you had put 3 million euros into that fund in late 2009, you would have 80 million euros today. Now, it is a very specialized fund. We only do Northern Europe. And we only do companies that are local service companies. And what we especially look for are things like this car wash company that look like manufacturing companies or being evaluated like manufacturing companies, but are really service companies with terrible geographic strategies. They're trying to go to China. They're trying to go to all sorts of places where they have subscale service infrastructure. And we go in and suggest to them that they kill that infrastructure. And we suggest to them that they concentrate on their core business and especially the service part of the business and get more efficient there. Now, sometimes that means cutting manufacturing errors, but you know, it's a very focused thing. And then in those industries, we know who the good managers are. So when we have to be an activist, we're not just gonna go to them and say, do this. We're gonna say, go to them, or this is a guy who's really gonna make this company much better. And we know who he is, and we know he's available because he's bored with being retired. And another example of that is Paul Hilal, who in his time with Bill Ackman was responsible for a huge percentage of Bill Ackman's performance and did 4 deals in 10 years, basically. And he was a serial expert in a sequence of industries, although railroads ultimately is what he did. But that's the way it's got to be. And nobody does that. Your analysts are talking to portfolio managers who don't have a clue because they're trying to juggle broad portfolios. I mean, I think that the way the whole industry is going to evolve is you're going to have investment analysts who are highly specialized. I mean, look, think of it this way. Suppose I spent my whole life doing onshore Texas Gulf Coast oil leases, and that's all I do. And you fly in from Germany and buy an oil lease from me. Who do you think made money in that transaction? And that's the way the world is going to be. That's the nature of competition. And people are not comfortable specializing yet. And then you're going to have people who are really good at risk assessment, who spread money among these very focused experts and are good at eliciting sort of risk profiles from them and put it together in a diversified portfolio.
Wonderful. Well, I think you answered this to a certain extent, but just to bring it back again. So blind investors have not done that. Well, I mean, hedge funds in general haven't done so good over the last decade. What would you attribute that to? Is it the interest rates not making the price discovery mechanism work?
Well, stay away from fixed income for a start. I mean, Jesus Christ. You're not going to make any money there. But no, the people who did bad, really badly, were the people who did not adapt to investing in franchise businesses. So it's the old, you know, balance sheet investors. And what they were left with in balance sheets were, you know, hugely overpriced Hong Kong real estate. So, you know, they had limited choices. They were not experts. And they just didn't adapt to the change in the world. I think if you look at the people who've had trouble, who did adapt, there are people who wouldn't specialize. I mean, you look at Warren Buffett in his 4 areas of specialty: banking, insurance, consumer non-durables, and old media. He's done really well. Outside of that, precision cast parts, you know, other areas, he hasn't done that well at all. So even somebody as smart as him, who is the greatest investor in some sense of all time, who did make the move to looking at franchise businesses, he still did much better as a specialist. So I think you've just got to come to terms with the fact you're going to have to specialize. And I'll tell one last story about that, because I think it's a really useful story.
Absolutely.
If you're going to be specialized, it helps to build communities of people with non-overlapping specialties. So there are groups of value investors in Japan. Well, there is a group of value investors in Japan. And in Japan, the real problems are all with corporate governance and management. These guys each have, they do small manufacturing and service companies, and they have regional specialties within Japan. And they're specialists in those regions, and they know the managements of the companies really well in those regions. And they meet regularly and exchange information. So each of them individually has a fairly narrow focus, which is very similar. So they have a sympathetic view of things. But you add them all together, the opportunities they have are just a multiple of what they start with. So I think the other thing you want to start thinking about is, in terms of research process, not doing not invented here. Do your specialties, dominate those specialties. And then if you've got to build a portfolio, look outside at what other people can offer you.
Wonderful. And lastly, what are your thoughts on ESG? Because there are sort of two conversations regarding ESG. One is you're holding corporations accountable on various factors, social, environmental, and others. And the other factions thinks that it's going to interfere with free markets. It's probably going to increase regulations for businesses. How would you personally?
Okay, let me talk about two things about that. The first thing is you have to know the history of the human race. That from Roman times, when we have the first good global data on standards of living, till 1800, sometime between 1800 and 1820, there is no net improvement in human standards of living. That the average 90% of the human race is essentially expensive livestock. They eat only staples. They live with their animals. They have one suit of clothes with a lot of different layers that come off and on with the seasons. Entertainment is what God provided for the propagation of the species, and getting drunk a couple of times a year. I mean, it's absolutely a rudimentary life. And there's a small, somewhere depending on the period, between 5 and 10% of the population that lives what we would think of as a human life. Starting in the 1820s, when the idea comes that you should not just find the best way to do something and do it that way forever, but every year you should get better and better, which is the notion of productivity growth, the world changes completely. And today, just about everybody in the world lives better than that 5 to 10%. Did in the old days. That's productivity growth. You do not want to interfere with that process. And that's the downside to ESG. And by the way, when you go from manufacturing, which are big centralized institutions, to services, which are smaller decentralized institutions, generating profit productivity growth gets harder. So ESG is coming along and impairing the focus on productivity growth at exactly the wrong time in the evolution of the global economy. That's the first thing. Second thing is that ESG, I think, never gets at the heart of the problem. I think they do what's fashionable. And here I want to talk about global warming. If we do not get population under control, I can guarantee you that we're not going to control global warming, because the aspirational poor people out there are going to want to live the way we live. And we're not going to lower our standards of living. Today, fertility rates everywhere in the world are just about below replacement. I think India is slightly above, but it's falling fairly rapidly, except in Africa. If you cannot control African population, we are going to be in a world towards the end of this century where we've got 6 billion poor Africans looking to do something, and that's not going to be good for the climate, and it's not going to be good for society. How much ESG attention do you think is devoted to that absolutely essential issue? None. So I'm really skeptical of ESG. I think it impairs the thing that's made humans, human life, what it is today. And I think it's really, it focuses on fashionable things, not on the absolute essentials.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more, I would have to say. Professor Greenwald, it was an absolute pleasure having you on the show, sir. We wish you a very happy retirement, and thank you for coming.
Well, and they were terrific questions, so thank you.